great pleasure for me to be here. You know, Gil came to Green Gulch Farm, where we were then living, about 1975, and he was, he's a little younger than my kids, actually, most of my kids. But he's, I have always had a great both affection and respect for him. And actually, when my husband wants to talk with a teacher about his practice, generally he comes to talk with Gil. We both have a very high regard for him, and I think the community he's built here is really quite wonderful, and I love coming to visit you. This name that's kind of difficult. We have these Japanese names, Senkei, means complete joy or inconceivable joy. It's quite a mystery to me why my teacher gave me that name at the time, but with some years of practice, I've come to really feel like that's a pretty good name for me. It really fits. So where he, you know, how he imagined that that was going to show up, I don't know. I want to talk a little bit today about theme in our practice that maybe I should say a little bit about Zen and how it differs a little bit from Vipassana. In the first place, I think that we make a little bit more, put a little bit more emphasis on posture in our first instructions for practice. And it may look like you see Zen monks sitting around, they look rather stiff. But it's not really true. It's the focus is on balance. And if you're sitting upright and balanced, your whole body can be at ease because you're not struggling with gravity. If you lean at all, you tighten up. I mean, just try leaning forward a little bit and feel how everything tightens to keep you from falling forward. Or if you lean back, everything tightens to keep you from falling back. And when you find that place right where you're just balanced and your weight is going directly down through your hips into the ground, there's no not necessary to have any tension in your body. So you can sit for a long time quite comfortably. So rather than being, also getting your head balanced over your spine, and your head gets out in front of your spine, these muscles that have to support it here that insert down around your shoulder blades start getting really tired and you begin to feel it. So while it may look a little stiff and formal, it actually is quite balanced and comfortable, and one can sit quite a long time with some ease. Also, we sit with a mudra, you know, with a mudra is just a hand pose, a hand posture. And this mudra has the feeling of can you see it in my... Maybe you still can't see it. But it's sort of like an energy receiver. You know, sort of receives energy from the universe directly to the energy center of our body. What's called hara in Japanese, or dantian in Chinese, which is considered the energetic center of our body. And then this mudra just rests on my feet, so I don't have to hold it up. And so the Zen training that I've had is in what's called the Soto tradition, which was brought to Japan from China by a young Japanese monk who went to China when he was 23. About like when Gil started to practice, I think, probably. and came back and founded the Soto stream of Zen in Japan. And the founder, Dogen Zenji, wrote a great deal, actually. He was quite a remarkable person. But one thing he wrote was called Genjo Koan, or just Manifesting True Reality. And in the one paragraph it says, to study the Buddha way is to study oneself, or to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened or verified, or enlightened is such a tricky word because it seems like something to get. It's just a wake up, you know. But to forget the self is to be confirmed by all things. To be confirmed by the myriad dharmas is to bring about the dropping away of body and mind, both of self and others. The traces of enlightenment come to an end, and this traceless enlightenment is continued endlessly. So this forgetting the self is a big theme in Soto Zen. And you know, the Buddha spoke of the three marks of all conditioned existence. All conditioned things have these three marks. What are conditioned things? Well, me and you and anything that comes about through causes and conditions. So he says all conditioned things have these three marks. One is impermanence. Everything changes. This is one of the kind of fundamental understandings of Buddhism. The second is, is dukkha in Sanskrit, which is usually translated suffering. It may be kind of a pervasive unsatisfactoriness, might be a little better way to translate dukkha. Origin of the word comes from a wheel where the axle hole is not exactly in the center. So it's something is always just a little bit off, just not quite right. It's not necessarily some intense, suffering is such kind of a big word that seems to imply some intense and terrible thing, but it's just never being quite satisfied, you know. Having those things that we like, we want a little more of. And those things we don't like, we want a little less of. And so we're never just ready to settle down and be right here, right now, who we are, as we are, in this moment, just this. Just completely entering our life fully as we are, and expressing yourself fully with this body and mind as it is. And the third mark of all conditioned things is said to be non-self, anatman. And so this is what Dogen Zenji is pointing to in this paragraph of Genjo Koan, forgetting the self. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And when we can forget the self, then we wake up to everything as it is. I don't know about you, but I have a lot of ideas of who I think I am. They don't stay the same all the time. Suzuki Roshi used to say, you exist as an idea in your mind. For me, it's more, it seems like a whole cluster of ideas. But you know, the teaching is that everything is included in each thing. There is nothing missing right here. This defining ourselves, when we define ourselves in any kind of dualistic way, that is, if we say, I'm this and not that, you know, any way we define ourselves is limiting whatever this is to less than its totality. Because in the teaching of the Buddha Dharma, each and every being is completely interbeing with all being. There is this image called Indra's net in the Avatamsaka Sutra, which I like very much. You're probably familiar with it. An image of the universe as a vast net. And at each of the crossing of the threads of the net, there is a jewel. That is, each being is a jewel in the vast interconnectedness of all being. And each jewel is reflected in every other jewel. And every jewel is reflected in each jewel. And this image tries to convey the fact that each being is completely independent at itself and simultaneously is completely interdependent with all being. I mean, if you look at your life, anything that you have, as they say in the Tibetan tradition, comes to you through the kindness of others. Everything, I mean, your body comes to you through the kindness of your parents. But your breath comes through to you through the kindness of plants. And their breath comes to them in photosynthesis through the kindness of animals. You know, we breathe out carbon dioxide and we need oxygen. And plants breathe out oxygen and they need carbon dioxide for photosynthesis. And everything, I mean, that's just the sort of a very obvious one that seems to me kind of so amazingly wonderful about how we are connected with everything. But, you know, the paper that this book is written on depends on trees and sunshine and rain and the loggers who cut it down and the paper mill workers who made it into paper and water and, I mean, all of this goes to make a piece of paper, which we take for granted. You know? But it depends on a great deal. And so anything you can point to in your life, you can see how it connects you with all the beings who made it happen so that you could now use it. This glass of water, I expect. Does your water come from Hetch Hetchy also? Yeah. 100 years ago, some people built a dam up there and put pipes in that brought it down here and put it in Crystal Springs Reservoir. And there are pumps and et cetera, and et cetera, et cetera. So I get to drink a glass of water. So this image of the complete independence, you know, we are completely independent and responsible for our choices of action. So that our actions are completely our own and our own responsibility. And at the same time, completely dependent on everything else in the universe. The Dalai Lama has written a book called The Universe in a Single Atom. And it's a fabulous book. I highly recommend it. And in it we see that our life and practice is really not about this self. It's about our relationship with all being. And how we express that relationship in our day-to-day activity of body, speech, and mind is our independence. There was a marvelous teacher here, actually, on the peninsula named Kobun Shino Roshi, who died a couple of years ago. He was giving a teaching once on the Buddhist precepts. And he said something that has just resonated in me ever since. He was leading a sesshin called Denkoe, which means sort of a sesshin for the gathering of light. Denko is transmission of light. The main subject of Denkoe is how to become a transmitter of actual light, life light. Practice takes place to shape your whole ability to reflect the light coming through you and to regenerate your system so the light increases its power. Each precept is a remark about hard climbing, maybe climbing down. You don't use the precepts for accomplishing your own personality or fulfilling your dream of your highest image. You don't use the precepts in that way. The precepts are the reflected light world of one precept, which is Buddha's mind itself, which is the presence of Buddha. Zazen is the first formulation of the accomplishment of Buddha existing. Zazen is means just sitting, which is what we call our meditation practice. Zazen is the first formulation of Buddha existing in the world. The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task. This is such a big responsibility that naturally, such a person sits down for a while. It's not an intended action, it's a natural action. So the precepts are the reflected light world of one precept, which is Buddha's mind itself, which is the presence of Buddha. Buddha just means one who's awake. And the presence of Buddha is not somewhere else. The presence of Buddha is right here, right now, in each one of us. There's no way for Buddha to express itself in the world, for awakeness to express itself in the world without us. So our practice is to wake up to the reality of our life and find a way to express it in the world. To wake up to the reality of our complete interdependence with all things. There was, in our tradition, a lot of the teaching is done by telling stories about somebody from about the 9th century in China. One such person was Dongshan Lianjie, called Tozan in Japanese. You may have heard of him. And he was one of the founders, actually, of Soto Zen. The toe of Soto Zen is from Tozan. And at the time that he was had been practicing with his teacher for some time and was leaving to go out on pilgrimage, he had a conversation with his teacher. Since when Dongshan was taking his leave, Yunyan, his teacher, asked, "Where are you going?" Dongshan replied, "Although I'm leaving you, I still haven't decided where I'll stay." Yunyan asked, "You're not going to Hunan, are you?" "No," replied Dongshan. "You're not returning to your native town, are you?" "No," replied Dongshan. "When will you return?" asked Yunyan. "I'll wait until you have a fixed residence," said Dongshan. Yunyan said, "After your departure, it will be hard to meet again." And Dongshan said, "It will be hard not to meet." Once you've practiced with a teacher, you know, you become quite intimate. And so you keep meeting your teacher wherever you go. So just before leaving, Dongshan said, "If after many years someone should ask me if I'm able to portray the master's likeness, how should I respond?" This is kind of a way of saying, what shall I tell people? Give me your teaching in a nutshell so that I can show it to people. You know, what shall I say is your teaching? I mean, he's been receiving this teaching in this intimate living and practicing together for some years. But you know, how should I characterize your teaching? You know, give me a pithy send-off here. After remaining quiet for a while, Yunyan said, "Just this is it." And Dongshan sighed. You know, that I always kind of resonate with Dongshan when he sighs there. I mean, that's all just this, you know. You don't have anything, there's nothing I can grab onto. Dongshan was lost in thought, and Yunyan said, "Acharya, having assumed the burden of this great matter, you must be very careful." Dongshan remained dubious about what Yunyan had said and went on his way. And later, as he was crossing a river, he saw his reflected image in the stream below. And he experienced a great awakening to the meaning of this exchange with Yunyan. And he composed the following poem. "Earnestly avoid seeking without, lest it recede far from you. Today I am walking alone. Yet everywhere I meet him. He is now no other than myself, but I am now not him. It must be understood in this way in order to merge with suchness." Sometimes that's translated, "Everywhere I go, I see myself." Everywhere I go, I see just this. I see this connection with everything. This is earnestly avoid seeking without. Don't look for Buddha out there. It's not outside of you, right where you are. Just this is it. The teacher Sherry Huber says that wrote a book called "That Which You Are Seeking Is Causing You to Seek." We keep having the notion that there's something missing here, that something we have to get in order to be complete. And what this teaching is just this is it. You are complete in this moment. There is nothing missing right here, right now. This feeling of something missing is this dukkha that the Buddha was talking about. I'm not quite right, you know. Just like this, how will we find our connection with all being right here where we are without looking outside to add something which is not missing? Suzuki Roshi said, the first lecture I ever give, he said, you're perfect just as you are. And I thought, well, he doesn't know me. I'm new here. But as long as I knew him, unfortunately I only had about 2.5 years with him, that feeling of complete acceptance, just like this, was always there. It was not that there wasn't also work to do to cultivate this body and mind. You know, he also said at some point, there's always room for improvement. You know? So this perfect doesn't mean, okay, well, I'll just lie back here and hang out. You know? This perfect means everything you need is right here. How will you engage it? How will you give it back to the world as a gift? Since it's been given to you as a gift, how will you return it as a gift? So how will we wake up to the completeness of this one just as it is? You know, we talk about cultivating compassion, and certainly cultivating the four unlimiteds is an important practices for all of us. But the only reason we can cultivate compassion is that we're born with compassion. It is part of our humanity. I mean, it's right here, always. And who of us, when we see some creature suffering, doesn't want to do something to help? It's a totally natural feeling. We do need to cultivate it, and we do need to forget the self. This is forgotten self. We need to get out of our way in order to be able to see what's really helpful here. How can I really meet this situation with kindness, with generosity, with compassion? All of these qualities that we cultivate in practice, we can cultivate because they're part of our birthright. You know? Just this includes compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. We do have to work on cultivating it. But the reason we can cultivate it is because it's already here. We don't need to look outside to find these qualities to add to what's here. We need to develop them and work on them and see where our ideas of self are interfering with the full expression of the four unlimiteds. We have this little thing called a Zen calendar that sits in the small kitchen at Zen Center. And somebody just collects sayings that they think are good Zen sayings from wherever and puts them on a calendar. And this one was from Henry Miller. I have to say, I'm not a literary person. I've heard of Henry Miller as a great writer. You know, he's a California writer. But I don't know that much about him, but this quote I really liked, and so I put a little note on the calendar. Please save this one for me. People are always doing that at Zen Center. I know what the great cure is. It is to give up, to relinquish, to surrender, so that our little hearts may beat in unison with the great heart of the world. That's it. I love it. Now this, give up this clinging to self. Just let go of this clinging to separateness and just be one with whatever we meet. And then we'll know what's the best thing to do in this situation. You know, one of the great Chinese teachers said, he asked his monks, what's the teaching of the Buddha's whole lifetime? And then he answered for them. And what's usually translated as an appropriate response. The literal meaning of the characters is each meets each, or one meets one. So what Yunmen is saying is the teaching of the Buddha's whole lifetime is to be able to meet whatever occurs to you and respond to it appropriately. So whatever you encounter, to meet it and respond with this great heart of the world that we all have. So, I mean, there are many of these stories in the records of the Chinese masters that have this punchline, just this is it. You know, it's not just this one exchange with Yunyan and Dongshan. For a while I was sort of collecting stories, you know. There's one about Ganto and Seppo, and there's anyhow, there. You will find this, just this is it. Because what it's pointing to is our life is just right here, right now, with what we encounter in each moment. And how we express fully this Buddha is to recognize our complete connection and interdependence with everything else. So that life is a continual process of giving and receiving. That we're receiving this gift of life all the time, and we're also offering it. You know, in Zen we have a lot of formalities. You've probably noticed. I don't know how many have you. Many of you ever been up to Zen Center? Yeah, I don't know. Anyhow, so all these formalities. But one of them I love is the way we serve our meals in the meditation hall. When we're having like a week long retreat, we eat sitting in meditation, and a number of the people who are doing the retreat are servers, and they come and they bow to each person and they serve them food and we bow back, and it's just this big sort of ceremony of offering and receiving, which I love because it's Yamada Muma and Roshi visited us once at Tassajara. And in the Rinzai tradition, this kind of very formal meal service is mostly a Soto-style event. So Muma and Yamada Roshi was a great Rinzai Zen teacher from Japan, and he came to visit Tassajara. And we gave him a set of eating bowls and cloths. You know, you unwrap the cloths and lay them out just so. And so he just followed Suzuki Roshi, Baker Roshi, who was sitting next to him. But after he says, that's wonderful, it's like a giant tea ceremony, you know. It's just kind of a wonderful example of giving and receiving, which is happening all the time. All the time we are receiving and giving this whole life to each other. So, you know, I'm supposed to talk for a few more minutes, but then would there be time for discussion after that if I talk for another 5 minutes? Or should I ask for, if anybody has comments or questions now?
You can do either, as you
okay.
You can stop talking at 10:45 and then
okay. Yeah. Well, let's just see. Does anybody have any questions or comments they would like to talk about at this time? Yes.
Talk a little bit about forgiveness.
Yes.
About forgiveness.
Ah. Forgiveness is. You know, we often may think that forgiveness is something we're giving another person. We're the ones who forgiveness is for us, so that we don't have to hold on any longer to the pain of whatever it is we're forgiving someone for. As long as we hold on to it, we continue to suffer the pain of it. And when we can open our hand and forgive whoever we feel has wronged us, you know, it may have been something really, really very painful, for which, you know, they're completely responsible. Even so, if we hold on to it, we continue to suffer with it. So, forgiveness is a gift to ourselves first. I think it's so also, I mean, wonderful for another person who has done something harmful to know that they've been forgiven. But the person who really, for whom forgiveness is really a great gift, is the person who gives it and can let go then of the continual pain that comes from holding on to anger or hurt. Anything else? Yes.
Thank you. You made reference to the book by the Dalai Lama.
Yes.
About the atomic age, and I wonder what in particular about it was compelling for you.
Well, it's just like it's. My background happens to be physics and chemistry. And he is just, you know, it's not all about physics, you know, but it does show how everything is connected with everything, for one thing, but also how the Buddhist teaching from 2,500 years ago fits in with modern understanding of how the universe works. So to me it was kind of thrilling. But he also talks a lot about just, you know, about the bodhisattva vow, about our, you know, this, what he's always saying is, everybody is just like you. Everybody wants to be happy and to avoid suffering just like you, you know. And one of the best ways to make yourself happy is to make others around you happy, you know. I find that a very helpful and instructive teaching. And how that comes into something that's all about science is kind of fascinating to me as well. How he can bring the bodhisattva vow right into quantum physics is pretty fascinating. I'm really, you know, I'm people ask me there's this question often, what happens when you die? You know, there's this question that's saying, a monk asked a Zen master, what happens when you die? And the Zen master said, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Aren't you a Zen master? Yeah, but I'm not a dead one. I was talking about something else when that came up. This is a problem about being 80. What were we talking about?